Welcome back, everyone, to the front line with Joe and Joe. Joe Pasillo and Joe Resinello.
Oh, you're exactly right, Joe.
We work for the man upstairs, as you do.
You're setting me up quite well. You just gave me an alley-oop.
The greatest revolutionary act you can commit right now is to open your mouth and speak the truth.
Whether you're an academic or you're a regular guy, we have to be fearless.
And once more, dear brothers and sisters, let us go into the breach. Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the front line with Joe and Joe. Joe Pasillo, as always, joined by Joe Resinello. And once more, dear brothers and sisters, let us go into the breach on the Veritas Catholic Radio Network, 1350 on your AM dial, 103.9 on your FM dial, spreading the truth of the Catholic faith to the New York City metropolitan area. We would really ask our audience, whether it's social media, whether it's on Veritas, to please share this conversation, okay, because we are very pleased and honored to be welcoming Rusty Reno, R.R. Reno, editor of First Things magazine, to our show for the first time, because he wrote an article that Joe Resinello stumbled upon called Engines of Destruction. Now, why am I saying this is important? Because First Things is like red meat for Joe Resinello and myself, okay, because First Things gets into the things that we need to talk about. So taxes are important, yes, and foreign policy is important, yes. But these are the things we need to be talking about. And in the Engines of Destruction, Rusty points out a couple of those things we need to keep our eye on. Let me give a quick bio. R.R. Rusty Reno is the editor of, like I said, First Things magazine. His books include Fighting the Noonday Devil, In the Ruins of the Church, and Redemptive Change, Atonement, and the Christian Cure for the Soul. He was formerly a professor of theology and ethics at Creighton University, where he taught theology and ethics for 20 years. In 2010, Dr. Reno took a leave of absence to work full-time at First Things, where he has remained the publication's editor since 2011. Rusty received a BA from Haverford College in 1983 and completed his PhD in theology at Yale University in 1990. Rusty Reno, welcome to the front line with Joe and Joe, our brother.
Great to be here. Great to be on the front line. That's where we all need to be, on the front line.
That's exactly right. We know how this conversation is going. We all need to be on the front line. Joe Resinello, I'm going to hand it over to you.
Rusty, we always begin our conversations with a prayer to Our Lady. In the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, amen. Remember, O most gracious Virgin Mary, never was it known that anyone who sought your help or sought your intercession was left unaided. Inspired by this confidence, we fly unto you, a Virgin of Virgins, our Mother. To you we come, for you we stand, sinful and sorrowful. O Mother of the Word incarnate, despise not our petitions, but in your clemency hear and answer us, amen. In name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, amen. Rusty, I don't want to take up too much airtime because we definitely want to talk about Engines of Destruction, but I do want to focus on the fact that you did teach at a Jesuit school. I went to a Jesuit college. I kind of want to compare notes because higher education is important. I also want to focus on your experience at Yale to understand what's going on in the Ivy League, because in many of these schools, we're forming the leaders of America, in some cases the world. When you were at Creighton, and again, I don't want to throw stones, full disclosure, I went to Scranton University. Then I went to St. Peter's College to get my MBA. I like to call it Harvard on the Hudson. And I have some views on the Jesuit experience. I'm interested in yours. How was your time at Creighton?
I would say mixed. You know, my joke about Creighton was that it was a Jesuit university, very confident about that. Catholic, not so much. And I think that's kind of probably characteristic across the board. So the negative there was an arm's length from the magisterium. And, you know, that was frustrating on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, I had to say that, you know, the kids were required to take three classes in theology to get their BA. And that's pretty substantial during my time there. And, you know, a person couldn't graduate from that school and think that only stupid people believe in God. And, you know, there's a lot to that. So I would say this. You know, I wish that the school had a more robust affirmation of the full scope of the Catholic faith, especially on moral issues. But I have to give credit to the school for, requiring every student to encounter, the theological reality of God's existence and and the reality of the church. So I'm mixed. You know, I was a blessing. I remember when I was interviewing for my job there, the Jesuit who was a department chairman said, "Why don't you come to my candlelight mass that I have 10 o'clock or 9 o'clock at night on Sunday?" I said, "Okay, sure." And I'm thinking, you know, maybe 20 kids or something, 500 students. And I thought, wow, I'm not in Kansas anymore. It's not, you know, so the student body was pretty pious, actually. And that created a very positive environment for a young person of faith who shows up on campus.
It's funny. I went to that mass. They had the same mass at Scranton, 9 o'clock on Sunday. I'm surprised I wasn't struck by lightning as I walked into it, though. But I did go to it. My experience was it was a school within a school. If you wanted, you know, a deep Catholic faith, there were people who did. And then there were a large circle did not. And it was a lot of partying. We had to take 2 semesters of theology, 2 semesters of philosophy, which I think is very good. I will say this, too. Some of the best people I ever met went to the University of Scranton. The mantra, people for others, is something the Jesuits do very well. Some of the best people I ever met in my life, some of which don't go to church, but live better than some practicing Catholics that I know, graduated from the University of Scranton, giving of themselves, who were gifted beyond comprehension. My roommate being one of them, 280 pounds, 6'3", the mind of an engineer. He teaches grammar school in the ghettos of L.A. So, I mean, does not go to church. So, I mean, like, I could say that my experience there was good, but I do think it's a little secular. And I think we could do better. And I think we're seeing that in Catholic schools moving forward in some of the new ones that are popping up.
Yeah, Joe, and I would say also that my 20 years teaching with Jesuits really helped me understand this pontificate.
Fair enough.
Part of it is that, you know, I kind of saw that these Jesuits would adopt these liberal theological ideas kind of instrumentally. Their piety was often quite traditional, but they thought the best way to bring kids into the church was to be loosey-goosey guitar mask kind of guys. And I think that they were mistaken. By the time I left in 2010, I think the trend had already shifted. Young people want actually the solid, this is why the Latin Mass is in such, is so popular with young people. They want solid, they want a solid anchor in tradition. They don't want loosey-goosey liberal Catholicism anymore.
I would agree.
And that's why, as you said, there are some, there's a lot of new life in Catholic higher education. And I think, you know, it's a good season we're moving into. You know, Pope Benedict said we were going to have a smaller, more faithful church. And I think we're seeing that. I was talking to a young priest friend of mine saying, it's a great time to be a priest. I mean, on the one hand, you're going to be exhausted because you're going to be overworked because there's not enough of you guys. But you are actually into ministry, coming into ministry at a time when people actually want what you are giving, as opposed to, you know, 1975, when a lot of cultural Catholics were still in church and they didn't want, they wanted it to be watered down. Very few people going to church now want it watered down.
Because there's nothing to it, Rusty. I mean, listen, if I'm sitting, I mean, I spent 20 years not practicing the Catholic faith and coming back to the church. I came back to the church because it's not like everything else, nor is it supposed to be like every other religion. Okay. Yeah. I don't want to play guitars and I don't want to sing "My God is an Awesome God." No offense to people that do, but I don't want to do that. I want hymns. I want obviously the Eucharist and reverence for the Eucharist. Because then what's the sense? I could just say, I believe in Jesus, read the Bible, I guess once a day or something like that, and just keep it moving. Because we want to segue into your article, okay, Engines of Destruction. You point out 2 pivotal developments, and I'm also going to tie this into education. One is immigration, mass immigration into the West, and the other is the green economic transition. And quite frankly, 2 28 and a half minute segments is not enough time to tackle both these things. And we would recommend, please, to our audience members, please go and subscribe to First Things. Okay. You do get 3 articles a month for free. But so if you're going to do that, then go read Rusty's article along with everything else on there. But you also went to Yale, and Yale ain't Creighton, and it ain't Scranton, and it's not Seton Hall University. Okay. To me, there might be some individual students who might have a particular religious or hold to a particular religious orthodoxy, but Yale and the rest of the Ivy League seem to be completely off the rails. You could correct me on that if I'm wrong. Their gods, or 2 of their gods, are, that you cannot question, are mass immigration and climate change. Right. So they've supplanted the real God with these other gods. Talk about, before we get into actually the details of everything, am I wrong in my assessment there, Rusty?
Yeah, I think, you know, we're spiritual animals, right? As St. Augustine said, our heart is restless until it finds its rest in thee. And so a kind of progressive moralism is the religion of secular higher education. I mean, it's kind of the liberal church now. The university is the progressive church. And so the dogmas of progressivism are, that's what the universities are, the magisterial, they're the magisterium for these progressive dogmas. So yeah, you're right. You can't question them. You get denounced as a heretic if you do. If you see it that way, it could give you some sympathy, right? Say, well, this is a kind of ersatz religion. And that these institutions have supplanted, you know, mainline Protestantism. People don't go to the Presbyterian Church or the Episcopalian Church in Westchester County, but they're still religious in some sense of holding to this intense moralism that, wow, it's so punitive. You know, it's called political correctness, not moral correctness, because it is a kind of, the moralism is politicized. But yeah, you can't question climate change. That's absolute dogma. And mass immigration, same thing. I mean, I've spoken at some Catholic universities. I'm a sort of token person they can find who actually says, well, wait a minute, you know, maybe our immigration policies need to change and be more restrictive. And so I'm always immediately denounced as a racist. I mean, so, yeah. You know, it's just unbelievable.
Rusty, how much of this is, and then we'll get into the meat and potatoes of your article, Engines of Destruction, available at First Things Magazine. How much of this is projection? You just mentioned this intense moralism, the suppression of free speech and inquiry and questioning and debate. These are all the things they've accused from the time I was a kid, I recognized all these liberal progressives accused the Catholic Church of that. You're too moralistic. You're too obsessed with these things. And you don't let people think freely. Well, you're doing the same darn thing. Well, you don't let people speak freely.
Well, I think it's worse because it's flat. You know, you kind of flatten the horizon. So it's all imminent. It's all has to do with this world. A religious person, you know, holds to a faith in God, but God is transcendent. So in a certain sense, it opens up space for you to actually discuss, you know, the affairs of the world without the same intense passion. I mean, you can be Catholic, you can vote for Democrats, you can vote for Republicans, you can think that we should raise taxes, you can think we should lower taxes. You could be Catholic and you could think, you can have different views on immigration. You know, what unites us is our faith in that, you know, Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and that in his death and resurrection, we are saved, have eternal life. I mean, wow, that's the center anchor. And so it gives us the freedom. We can still have fellowship as we discuss and debate the matters of public importance in our time. But the problem with secular progressivism is that they make their dogmas political. And so they're the ones driving the culture war. People say, you know, polarization. They say, you know, it's people like us that they think are driving polarization. No, no, no. It's the progressives. They're the ones who are making political judgments into absolute dogmas.
Yeah, Rusty, I'm gonna make a quick comment. I'm gonna hand it over to Joe. But, you know, they, Actually, you know what? I'm going to hold that thought. I'm going to hold that thought because we want to get a little to more of the meat and potatoes. Joe, where do you want to go with Rusty
Reno? I want to talk about your immigration view because I want to paint the full picture. And I just want to draw a parallel by an example. I have five children. I live in a house. I am all for fellowship. I'm all for sharing what I've been given by God. And I look at all things that I've been given as a gift. However, I don't keep my door wide open for the people on the street because I have to feed my children first. That's my first priority. America has always welcomed the immigrant. My grandfather came from Italy. I am not for merit-based immigration as Donald Trump is. All people should be able to come in.
I agree with you on that, by the way, Joe. I'm also opposed to merit-based immigration.
The engineer from France should be able to come in as well as the laborer from Honduras. I'm all for it, but there has to be prudence and limits. Talk about that, because I think it's too easy to just brush this conversation off like, you're anti-immigrant, you're racist. No, I love people, all people, and I want to share the bounty of America, but clearly this is not working, and I think this is being used as a political tool, frankly. And you live in New York City, and I work in New York City, and it's a mess. It is a mess. It's not working. Talk about that. Paint the full picture.
My line is you can't exercise hospitality if you don't have a home. So Joe, you can't invite people to share a fellowship in your home if your home's a mess, if it's disintegrating. And I think people need to realize that there are limits to what a society can absorb in the way of newcomers and actually maintain its coherence and the social trust that we need as a people to be a democratic society. So, you know, after World War II, you know, I think peak, the lowest level was around 3%. In 1970, 3% of all residents of the United States were non-native born, 3%. We're now touching 14%, which was the historic high in the 20s before immigration laws were passed and immigration was restricted. So, okay, 14%. I had these debates. Well, maybe 14% we can deal with, but 18%, 20%, 25%. At some point, we have to recognize that there are limits to what our country can absorb in the way of newcomers. And I think clearly we're reaching those limits. And I think a prudent statesman has to intervene and limit the inflow of newcomers. And I just think that's just common sense. I mean, people, and just think about the people who want to come here. Why do they want to come here? They want to come here because they want to participate in the fruits and the benefits of our society. But, you know, at some point, if our society is more like, you know, Honduras or Mexico than it is like the United States, then it's like, you know, that kind of spoils the bounty that, you know, we want our country to provide for people who do come. So just prudent limits. I think as Americans, we should be very grateful that our country is actually set up to assimilate people. And I think we will succeed, but we won't succeed if we don't get a handle on the inflow. And so I think we need to press the pause button and enter into a season of digestion, so to speak, to digest all the newcomers who have come in the last 20 and 30 years. So that we can remain a country that welcomes newcomers rather than one that's overwhelmed by newcomers. I just don't think it's that complicated.
Rusty Reno's joining us here at the Frontline with Joe and Joe, editor of First Things magazine. Please go online and subscribe to First Things because you're not just going to read the article we're discussing, which is Engines of Destruction. On there, there are some of the best writers out there that are hitting the nail on the head. That's the thing. We say all the time at the Frontline with Joe and Joe, we have to have knowledge of what's going on around us. And quite frankly, Rusty, you know, I don't have the time to research all this stuff. That's why we need people like you out there who are commenting.
I would say, I mean, also, you know, I get my morning cappuccino from this guy who opened a little shop down the street from my apartment. And, you know, he's Tibetan. You know, his parents fled with the Dalai Lama in 1950 when the Chinese took over Tibet. He was born and raised in South India, immigrated to the United States when he was 13 years old with his family. entrepreneur, like he's great. He's this, he's you know, immigrants do, they do renew our country. I love him. But it's interesting. I asked him, what do you think about the whole migrant situation? He was disgusted by how, by the, just the illegality, the complete lack of any limitation. And he said to me that we put them in the Roosevelt Hotel while our people are sleeping on the streets. Now, that's a beautiful statement. A person not born here speaking about his fellow Americans as our people. And that sense of responsibility for one's own. The problem is, what is with our elite? Why don't they feel that sense of responsibility? And what's wrong with the people running our country? Why is it that some, you know, small-time little shop owner from Tibet actually understands what it means to be a fellow citizen? We take care of our fellow citizens first.
Yeah.
And I think I've heard rich people talk about how, oh, well, you know, unemployment's at 3%, you know, native born Americans, you know, they're drug addicts. They can't pass drug tests. We need to bring in new people. I mean, I've heard them say that often. Mm-hmm. And you think, I just want to, you know, smack them in the face and say, well, maybe you've actually, you know, the last 50 years, you've set up a country that's a culture that is so toxic that it shipwrecks the people who are born here. And your solution is to import people from elsewhere rather than actually maybe reforming our culture so it's not so degraded, and so that young people aren't, you know, don't wind up killing themselves from drug overdose death. And, you know, we're at 50% touching now 50% of all children born out of wedlock. I mean, is this a recipe for a functional country? No. And look, quietly, billionaires, they recognize this. And I think quietly, they think, bring in these people from elsewhere. And, you know, they'll be functional because they bring the social capital from their own countries. You know, they bring in a more traditional outlook. You know, but then you say, are we really doing them a favor? Because what are their children and grandchildren? How are they going to turn out in a society that celebrates, you know, that celebrates the whole, that was always waving the rainbow flag and celebrating, you know, the LGBT agenda? And yeah. So anyway, I'm kind of ranting here. Sorry about that.
Oh, that's okay, Rusty. But real quick, I love in the article that you, I'm going to steal, I'm not borrowing it, I'm stealing it, okay? The two words, Rainbow Reich. Yeah. I think it's so appropriate.
There's no, they do not tolerate, I mean, it is an empire, a Reich, and it's a deliberate echo of Nazism. It's a ruthless in the way that they will punish anyone who dissents from their dogmas.
Let me explore Rusty. That a little bit, because I don't, because I always try to think of when people hear things, like, if ultimately God does not impose himself on others, nor do we. I am very tolerant of people who choose a route that, in my view, is a mortal sin. I love them as they are, and I love them so much I want them to change. However, they're not tolerant of me. I pay taxes. And that's why I think that's an appropriate, like, you know, like, euphemism here, because my view is not respected. I have children. I can't send them to public school. I can't send them because they're going to learn about anal sex when they're 8. And that is twisted. That is twisted.
Joe, what the dynamic here is this. They're proposing, they're advocating an affirmation of things that are contrary to nature. And so, you know, there's a kind of way in which the conscience still whispers the truth, the moral truth to them. So you have to suppress every voice of moral truth in order to create the sort of psychological freedom to do these things that are contrary to nature. So the activism is just, it's a never going to end, you know, because you have to keep we have to keep conscience at bay. Whereas we can say, look, you know, it's wrong, you know, but, you know, often in Catholic moral teaching, you know, you don't make illegal things where sometimes the harm done to society is greater by, you know, like if you, if you punish lying or deceit or things like that, it's just that the punitive effort would do more harm than good. Mm-hmm. And you can see that with respect to many aspects of, you know, the Puritan experiment in New England. You know, they tried to impose morality much too completely through the power of the state, and it was counterproductive.
Yeah, one of the things we say
is that they cannot recognize that.
Right, right. And Rusty, I mean, this is one of the reasons why Joe and I, at the prompting of a very good priest, decided to start doing this show, along with a lot of other people out there, of course, in publications like yours, First Things Magazine, is that we have to try to raise the consciousness of the people so that they understand what's going on. Okay, why? Because I have a PhD on the wall? I don't. But you mentioned common sense earlier. There is no common sense. These things you can argue with. You don't need an arsenal of degrees to you just say, hold it. What are you talking about? Some transvestite could read a book to a five-year-old kid in a library. What are you talking about? You want to transition kids at 8 years old about their parent without their parents' approval? What world do you live in? Rusty, your comments. We have about a minute or two before the break.
One of the hardest things when you're growing up is to figure out how to be a man or a woman, how to be a woman when you're an adolescent, when you're in puberty. And the idea that we're going to disorient kids with respect to the difference between men and women, I just, as a recipe, if you think mental health for young people is bad, you wait till this current generation comes of age. It's going to be in the toilet. And why? Because we've adopted these absolutely insane policies with respect to deliberately disorienting children with respect to what it means to be a man and a woman. Crazy.
And that's the thing too. It's so blatant. Like the things that you hear, Rusty, like let's say, you know, Joe and I have to go on social media because that's where we find a lot of information that we want to use on the show. When someone gets up, a teacher gets up in front of a school board and says, what qualifies the parents to teach their children? and nobody like remember back in the day with vaudeville, you used to get the hook, you know, like the hook would come in and take them off the stage, right? It's like, where was the hook on this teacher? I hesitate to call her a teacher. Where's the hook on this teacher to say, excuse me, I am the primary educator of my children. You cannot take that right away from me. I don't care how much political power you have. See, that resonates with people, Rusty. People don't like that. All right. People are very tolerant in America, Joe and I believe. But when you start crossing that line into you're going to tell me that I can't teach my children, let's say, the Catholic faith and the truth about sexuality, that's where we draw the line. Rusty Reno, we're going to take a quick break. We're here at the front line with Joe and Joe on the Veritas Catholic Radio Network. So, Rusty, it's firstthings.com, correct?
That's it.
Firstthings.com.
Read us.
We would encourage everybody out there to please go and subscribe and go and read their articles. Fantastic authors, again, equipping us to fight this culture war that we're in. If you think we're not in a spiritual battle, a culture war, then you have your head in the sand and you need to get your head out of the sand. One of the ways you do that is you listen to The Front Line with Joe and Joe and you share our videos all around social media and our radio show by downloading the Veritas Catholic Radio Network app and sharing it with your friends. So we have Rusty Reno here for another fantastic segment where we're going to talk Ad Gaia. Be right back.
Catholic radio works. And now we have it here in Connecticut and New York. It's been seen around the country that there's no better tool for evangelization. Where there's Catholic radio, the folks who listen deepen their faith. Families are strengthened. Parishes and communities flourish. So, let people know you're listening to Veritas. Tell your friends to tune in. And let's make an impact here for Jesus and His church. This is Steve Lee for Veritas Catholic Network.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Front Line with Joe and Joe. Joe Pistillo, Joe Rasinello. We're way in the breach with Rusty Reno, the editor of First Things Magazine. Please go to firstthings.com and subscribe there. And the information you're going to have there be overwhelming and incredibly valuable. Joe and I, social media, Veritas Catholic Radio, please share these conversations because they're important conversations. Joe Rasinello, I'm going to hand it over to you.
Let's talk green transition. I think this is something that a lot of people are missing because it's happening in plain sight. Something I always say to people is this: if you are in the middle class, you cannot afford to vote for people who embrace this ideology, because frankly, it's driving the prices of everything out of your paycheck. You can't afford milk. I've seen, my wife just told me, a Happy Meal at McDonald's is like 18 bucks. I mean, because of meat. They don't want you to eat meat. Talk about how this is impacting the middle class. Globalists are destroying the middle class. And frankly, if you are in the middle class and you're voting for someone who embraces this ideology, they're slitting your throat. Am I wrong?
Yeah, I think the listeners need to just think, realize that the green transition is it's a fundamental, I mean, think about, we spent the 20th century building out an energy infrastructure around first coal and then petroleum. So, I don't know, back of the envelope, $50 trillion, $100 trillion. I mean, really, the amount of capital investment in that energy system is just quite extraordinary. And now we're embarking in a very short period of time to basically reduplicate that energy system with so-called green energy. So the expenditure of funds is huge. Some of it is government money, but a lot of it is just costs that are transferred to consumers, Joe, as you pointed out. They're hidden. I mean, nobody's kind of tracing to say that, you know, because we have to spend, you know, basically five times our GDP over the next 10, you know, it's just, the numbers when you add them up are just insane. And it's going to come, the money comes from somewhere. And it comes from out of the pockets of all of us. And, you know, if you're rich, you can afford the extra increase of 10 or 20% in food prices. But if you're living from paycheck to paycheck, you're just going to get crushed by this. So it just strikes me as kind of insane. The Europeans are farther along. They're more purists. And you see with the farmer protests and so forth in Europe that now that the rubber's hitting the road, so to speak, people are waking up and realizing, well, wait a minute, this isn't going to work. We can't actually live on this regime. So I think it's the United States, we've been more, herky-jerky. And a lot of the pain has been masked by deficit spending. You know, the Inflation Reduction Act has all these incentives for green energy. You know, and when it was first passed in 2021, the estimate was something like $600 billion, and it's gonna go way over a trillion in spending on these green deals. As one of my friends put it, who works in here on Wall Street, it's a massive wealth transfer from middle class people to the rich.
But isn't that ultimately the goal, Rusty? I think that that's something that's just so easy to recognize, that going back to Obama with trying to create like a 30-hour work week through Obamacare and, you know, all of that stuff. I mean, why is it that people don't get through their head? Go look at a picture of San Francisco. Go look at the structure of San Francisco with the elites. There's a picture online, Rusty. And Joe and I brought it up on the show a million times, where in the foreground of the picture, a man is defecating in the street. And in the background of the picture, there's people sitting in the sidewalk cafe eating Grey Goose and drinking eating foie gras and drinking Grey Goose. And my thing is this, that's what they want. See, a vibrant, dynamic middle class. Yes. Dare I say a religious middle class. Okay. Does not need government. We don't need them. We don't listen to elites. We don't really, quite frankly, care what they say, because we are self-sufficient. Am I off in my assessment that this is one of the things, reasons why they push climate change, is they want to wreck the middle class and just get rid of it completely so that there's rich and then you have your slave class?
Yeah, Joel Kotkin has written a lot about this. He calls it the new feudalism with the top 10%. Or let's call it the top 1%, and then they have a kind of therapists and lawyers, and you know, there's a whole service industry around the super rich. You see that in places like Westchester County. Yeah, I do think. Do they want it? That may be going too far, but are they? The way I think is this: why do they not do anything about it? Like, why do they just let the system grind forward and continue to erode middle class prosperity? And I think there, Joe, what you're saying is correct. They intuitively recognize that a vibrant, self-confident, religious middle class will hold them accountable and will, you know, limit their power. And so really, if I was advising the billionaires, I would say the more you degrade and demoralize the median American, the more unrestricted power you will have, because those people will become clients of your patronage rather than independent actors. I mean, Tocqueville recognized this in his book, Democracy in America, that, you know, the more atomized people become, the more dependent they are on the state. Mm-hmm. So probably in my thinking, kind of the paradigmatic figure here is the sort of single childless woman. You know, that's the Julia ad. Remember that from the Obama campaign in 2012? Julia the woman. And at every stage in her life, the ad would show how the government did all these wonderful things for her. And I see that as sort of my nightmare scenario. You know, our society dominated by single childless women who I think are, you know, they're going to be angry. Whose fault is this, my life? And then, you know, it'll be progressivism turbocharged.
All right. Joe Racinello.
You talked about why are they allowing this? And this is my view, and I'm interested in both your opinions, because I believe the climate is their religion. It's a religion. They've replaced God with it. They just went to fancy schools and wear fancy suits where the cave people drew with ox blood on a wall. But it's the same idea. It's the same idea. And to them, it's religion. And that's why middle class people vote for it, too, because it's their religion. Oh, I'm going to make a sacrifice. I'm basically living for something that's, you know, noble. It's noble. I like the environment. The Lord calls us to be stewards for the environment. I like people more. And God gave us the environment to basically take care of each other and to take care of it. But it's twisted. It's their religion. And talk about that, because it is fanatic. When you listen to like the World Economic Forum, some of the voices that come out of that group of people.
Scary, brother.
It is horrifying. Horrifying. And I don't think people are paying attention to it. Rusty, I'll be truthful with you, because God knows the mainstream media isn't. And they do that on purpose because they all eat from the same trough, if you ask me. Ultimately, these people are going to destroy regular people. And it's happening. I see it where I shop. I mean, food prices are off the charts. People yes. can't in Canada. I follow the news and I cover the news there. Canada, buying a home for a regular person is completely out of the question.
Out of the question.
One in five people are eating in food banks in Toronto. I mean, what is going on? This is Canada. Like, please.
Well, Rusty, talk about the religious aspect of this, because it does seem.
Well, you got Greta Thunberg, kind of the prophet. You know, there's no doubt that people have a sense of their own sinfulness. And that, you know, the climate change is a way, they kind of relish the idea of climate catastrophe. You know, we're going to be punished and we deserve it, you know. And there's definitely a strong streak of that that runs through climate extremism. Undoubtedly, a kind of, you know, judgment day is coming and we deserve it. Now, my view is, I got my own religion. It's actually the true one that we share. And so I think the three of us can look at this kind of soberly and say, is there climate change? I mean, good grief, where I'm sitting now, it was covered in ice, you know, 20,000 years ago. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that the last ice age occurred. So is the climate changing? I mean, it's always changing. And so is it caused by human beings? Maybe. But I look at it and say, we're very clever animals, we human beings. And remediation is way, way more intelligent and way less costly than this kind of futile effort to kind of basically completely reinvent the energy foundations of the modern economy. Remediation, you know, we could figure out how to deal with these kinds of changes. We don't have to throw ourselves into this kind of quasi-religious crusade. And I think I'm with you guys. It's really shipwrecking the foundations of our economy. And, you know, and like, for instance, for the climate purists, like, well, okay, let's concede all of their premises. Why aren't we embracing and accelerating the rollout of nuclear power? Right? I mean, are we like being rational here? No. The climate purists, they don't want to touch it. No, we shuttered Stony Point nuclear power plant here in New York, you know, under, Governor Cuomo just before the pandemic. So I find myself thinking, well, so now back to your guys' point. Well, is there a kind of a conspiracy here if they're not doing the obvious things? And it does make you a little more sympathetic to the conspiracy idea. I always tell people when they say, well, it's a World Economic Forum conspiracy, I'd say, no. It's much worse than that. It's not a conspiracy, my friends. It's a consensus.
You know, Rusty, let me stay there one second on the World Economic Forum. When people call us conspiracy theorists because we have these conversations, okay, we're using what they say themselves, what comes out of their own mouths. It's not right. Like, I'll give you a perfect example. Scares the bejesus out of me, okay? This, you talk about prophets or false prophets. This guy, Yuval Harari, there's a video going on out there, going around lines. I think it's a TED talk or something like that, okay? Yeah. Where he's actually telling the audience there are no such things as rights. That if you open up a person and you look inside, you won't find these rights. That these things, like God, we make up to make ourselves feel better. So, and the reason why I bring that up is to say, we're not connecting any dots, or we're putting it like this, the only dots we're connecting as quote unquote conspiracy theorists are using the words that are coming out of your very mouth.
Yes.
Now let me stay here for a second, Rusty, because this is something that I'm very interested in. I want your opinion on it. Okay. Obviously the Soviet Union collapsed. All right. Back in 1991, that never met. Now people said, and I used to laugh at this, you know, when Al Gore got up there, when he was running against Bush, said, we defeated communism. You didn't defeat communism. Communism is alive and well. Just because the Soviet Union collapsed doesn't mean that communism is not alive and well, or at least the Marxist impulse, okay, to try to control. Number one, to destroy Western civilization, okay, and to destroy the belief in God, and then make themselves into gods. This is the way I view the world. I look at the Marxists like the Black Book of Communists highlighted. The book came out 30 years ago, that communism is an international criminal conspiracy. That's the way I see it. I look at all these things when it comes to letting immigrants flood into Europe and America and the green climate agenda and all that. I look at all of it as a criminal conspiracy, because what they're trying to do is wreak havoc on a global level, okay, get rid of a lot of people, and then have the control that somebody like Stalin could have only dreamed of. Now, I know that was a little bit of a rant, Rusty Reno.
But I would say I don't think it's a conspiracy to wreak havoc. Instead, it's, you know, it's the old line about, the people running our country are so smart, but so stupid. In other words, I think they really do think, well, we can really orchestrate this. And we can, you know, multiculturalism, if we have enough DEI officers and enough sharing and programs, that we can really kind of orchestrate this wonderful multicultural future. And they don't just recognize the limits of the tragic character of life and the limits of human reason. And so what they do is they wreak havoc because they falsely think that they can control events and orchestrate these grand, roll out these grand transformative plans. And that is obviously, Marxism is this, grandiose theory of history, and that once you understand where history is going, you can be a tool to bring it about. And instead, you wreak havoc, and a lot of innocent lives are lost. And in that sense, I do agree with you. The outcome will be chaos, and that's one of my fears. Like, if the people running our country don't get their heads on straight, then they're going to lead us into an abyss. And as is always the case, the rich, they have a safety valve. They have an escape hatch. Ordinary folks do not. So it's the ordinary guy and gal who's going to wind up paying the price for these misguided efforts.
Oh, absolutely. Rusty Reno is joining us here at the Frontline with Joe and Joe, editor of First Things magazine, firstthings.com. Please go on the website and subscribe. And there's a lot of information there that you're definitely going to be able to use. Joe Racinello.
As a result of a lot of things we're talking about, you're seeing populist presidents, surface throughout the world. Italy, Argentina, and Trump. He's a populist. How do you see that trend going? Will the globalists just muscle these folks out? You're seeing what they're doing in Hungary. Clearly, he's not on the hit parade of the EU, and they're doing everything they can to fight against him. But clearly the press is not on their side. But this is what the people want. Yet, and I thought this was interesting, you noted in the same magazine, January 2024, a post-democratic error, where basically it's like the people vote, like Brexit, they want this, and then the government says, no, thank you very much, sit back down. And we're seeing this. You noted what happened in Germany recently. It's dangerous, and it's happening right in front of people, and yet people accept it. Your comments on that, because I think you hit it right on the head.
Well, people are accepting it less and less. There's a rising tide of frustration throughout Western democracies. And as that frustration builds, voters are disobeying their betters. Ordinary people are disobeying what they're told they must do and believe. And as that disobedience rises, the efforts by elites to effectively veto the general populace, that they increase. I mean, obviously these prosecutions of Trump are a good example of using the legal system in order to stymie the will of the populace. You mentioned Brexit. There, it wasn't legal mechanism. It's just inaction by elites. If you're gonna change things, somebody has to actually institute the change. And we saw this, Trump has got his doubts about NATO. I think he speaks in a kind of crude way, but I do think he did this back in 2016, and my friends were all up in arms, my establishment friends. And I said, well, but wait a minute, what is the purpose of NATO post-Cold War? I mean, nobody really sort of explained to me, at least, what this alliance's purpose is now. And so don't we need to think about that? So anyway, I do think that we're in this very dangerous dynamic of, people need leaders. None of us want to actually run the country. We want to do our jobs, take care of our kids, enjoy our families, go to church. But we want to be able to elect and have a say in the people running our country. So it's achieving that balance to have a leadership class that's it's in sync with the general population. And we've lost that sync. We're out of sync. And this is true throughout the West. Elites are economically detached from ordinary people. They're culturally detached from ordinary people. And increasingly, that's manifesting itself in that they're politically detached from ordinary people. That's a dangerous situation. We need to get back into sync. They think they can browbeat the general voter and force the populace to be in sync with them. But no, I think it needs to go the other direction. And you saw Jamie Dimon at the World Economic Forum recently, last month. He gave an interview where he said, you know, we do have a problem. And he effectively said that people like me are out of sync with ordinary American. So I took part in that. I said, okay, well, maybe the top dogs, the elite in our society, maybe they're beginning to sort of recognize they need to make some adjustments. They need to do a little bit of a reality check. And so I'm an American optimist in this regard. We're going through a tough patch, but I think we'll get through this.
Rusty Reno, let me ask you this. Have you ever in your lifetime, see, I when I say these things, if I need to be corrected, correct me. I don't remember Ronald Reagan when I was young. I don't remember Ronald Reagan attacking the people that voted Democrat. Yeah, I don't remember. And I don't remember, in fairness, I don't remember Bill Clinton doing that either.
I agree. Okay? This is distinctive to our, you mean the whole makers versus takers, Romney. Effectively, you have a presidential candidate deriding half the country, and then you have Hillary Clinton deplorables comment. That's a bad sign. It is a bad sign when sort of the people running the country have a negative view of wide swaths of the population. That's not good. That's not, and that's a symptom of exactly, Joe, what you're talking about. And that was not the case. It was not the case previously. And then you get Joe Biden, anybody who votes for Donald Trump is a racist, Jim Crow 2.0.
Yeah.
I mean, those are assassination words. You know, you call someone a racist, that's a career assassination.
And they'll say, Rusty, they'll say that Donald Trump did the same thing. And I've had this conversation. No, he did not. He attacked the press.
Yes,
the press is the enemy of the American people.
He said our country is run by very stupid people. See, he loves to attack, you know, the leadership class. And that's why people vote for him. An enemy of my enemies is my friend. And who knows what'll happen in this upcoming, it's a crazy year, and events always shape things in unexpected ways. But, you know, the Democratic Party coalition was kind of elite, progressive elites and a coalition of outsiders, you know, and Catholics used to be part of that outsider Democratic coalition. And that's broken down over the last 30, 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and now the Democratic Party is increasingly the party of the college educated. Obama was the first Democratic candidate to win the majority of people who make more than $250,000 a year. Those used to be classic Republican voters, you know, the sort of country club class.
Right.
But think how much things have changed over the last 20, 30 years. Now the country club party is the Democratic Party. That's the party of people who are the winners in the global economy. And the Republican Party is increasingly the party of people who are the losers in the global economy. So we're flipping. Our political system is flipping in all kinds of interesting ways. And this disorients the chattering class, the media. It's why you read the New York Times, you think, these people, aren't they paying attention to reality?
Right, and they're supposed to be the smartest people in the room.
So they
tell us, Rusty Reno.
Yeah.
Rusty, we really don't have a lot of time left, but I'm going to throw it over to Joe, and we'll try to squeeze in one more question for you.
I'm going to talk solutions. We've been doing this, Rusty, for...
Joe, we got about 2 minutes, just so you know.
We've been doing this for quite some time, and what I have found is you could throw facts at people, you could be very linear, and they don't resonate. What I think the solution is radical Catholic living. I look to what Benedict XVI said in his 1969 address. We have to be prophetic by living radically. And as darkness embraces the culture, and it has, they will see a light on the hill. from the remnant. We have to be willing to do that. Your thoughts on that being the solution?
I agree. I think, you know, I kind of poo-pooed Rod Dreher's Benedict Option when it came out. I thought it was too dark and catastrophic in its portrait of our situation. But I think he was right. I was wrong at that time. And that the church is distinctive in our present moment. It's the only institution that's not selling you something 24/7, not manipulating you. I mean, the media increasingly trying to sell you through fear mongering, get you addicted left and right, Fox and MSNBC. Mm-hmm. And so I think the church that Catholics have a distinctive role to play in the future of the West. Just as the monastic movement during the Dark Ages preserved the best of classical culture and laid the seeds for Western culture, I think we're going to be having a very similar role as we move towards, I think, a very increasingly difficult times.
I'm glad you mentioned the monasteries, which built Western civilization, but yes. Yet they were somewhat insular communities, but then they worked or at labor, it was pray and work, and that just spread and became the center. Listen, you're talking, I don't want to disparage our German and English and friends, but England, they were savage. Ireland was, was barbaric. Germany was barbaric. No, it was that view, Benedict's view, civilized these people.
They were islands of peace in a violent world. And I think for us, the church, these are islands of reason, actually, in an increasingly insane world. And also islands of contemplation in a world that it's just overwhelmed by a kind of consumer get mentality. And I think in both of those senses, both reason and contemplation, those are the sparks of something that we're going to preserve them, and that'll nurture whatever comes after this kind of insane time that we're living through.
Rusty Reno, that's a great place to leave it. Thank you so much for this conversation. Like I said, I wasn't just saying it when I said we were pleased and honored to have you on the show. We've been enlightened. We love this conversation. Needless to say, you are welcome back at the front line with Joe and Joe anytime, our brother. So we really appreciate it. And we would encourage everybody out there to go and subscribe to firstthings.com, firstthings.com, where you're going to be able to read a lot of this stuff. Engines of Destruction, that's your first assignment if you're listening to the Frontline with Joe and Joe. That's Rusty's article. You'll find it on there. Rusty Reno, thanks again. Thank you all out there for joining us on the Veritas Catholic Radio Network. And remember, until the next time, that our conversation is your conversation, and that conversation is going on everywhere. We'll talk to you soon.